Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. You have me and the fabulous Christopher. Chris, tell us who we've got on.
Morning, Alina. We have got Dr. John Wolfe, who is a historian and researcher who specialises in the Victorian period and has written books on the wonders, lifting the curtain of the freak show, circus and the Victorian age, amongst others. And he's here today about his new book, which he co-authored with Dr. Tisha Abraham, a book on Black Victorians. John, welcome to History Hack.
Thanks very much for having me. And Keisha sends her regards and sorry she couldn't be here today, but she's here in spirit.
John, this is not your first rodeo on with us, is it?
No, it's not. No. You very kindly had me on when The Wonders came out.
We did, and that was with me and Alex, and we had a right good blast chatting away about, oh my God, that was some of the craziest stuff from the Victorian. I mean, the Victorians are just mad.
I know, they're next level, aren't they? Well, that was the thing that really sort of inspired this latest project, really. It was on the back of the work on the Victorian Freak Show that in a sort of very roundabout way led me to this topic.
Well, you co-wrote it with Keisha Abraham. Mm. And do you know what? She's not here with us, unfortunately. So tell us a little bit about her and how did you guys work together and how did you manage to kind of put all this together?
Oh, well, so she's amazing. I mean, she's based in Miami at the moment and she's currently traveling around, but she's coming to London soon. So we'll be doing a couple of events together. But it was slightly strange, really, in that she had worked closely with my dad in the realm of international education and Black Jewish dialogue. So I knew Keisha for quite some time. But initially, I'd set out to build on the work of the Victorian Freak Show by looking at the phenomenon of ethnographic exhibitions or so-called human zoos, the display of people from across the globe brought to Britain and presented almost as freaks of nature on the basis of the colour of their skin. And so I was looking at this phenomenon of ethnographic exhibitions, which kind of went from small scale transitory affairs at the start of the 19th century to large scale commercial forms of entertainment by the end of the 19th century. But the more I was researching and coming across, like, you know, so-called Zulus and cannibals and the sort of racism and inferiority that was imputed onto these individuals, the more I was actually being taken to different archives and to a world outside of the ethnographic exhibition. And there's been some great work on ethnographic exhibitions. And I, you know, started speaking to Keisha about some of the other research. And the long story short, essentially, I decided I didn't want to write and focus on the history of ethnographic exhibitions, confining Black Victorian experience just to that one realm of entertainment. And in fact, looking at the interconnection, and that's a really important point, the interconnection, interdependency between British history and Black history in the 19th century. And so with Keisha, we looked at a range of different individuals across the social spectrum in all different areas and walks of Victorian life, and decided to tell a story about the Victorian age, which focused on race in the 19th century.
Which is really interesting, because they have quite a roller coaster through the Napoleonic period. But at the very beginning, the British Empire have just abolished transatlantic slave trade, and we have people of the Black community living in England. What was the aftershock of the abolition for them, and who were the Black community in England at the time?
Yeah, so you have abolition coming in at the beginning of the 19th century. And, you know, I think it's really worth saying that, you know, the call for abolitionism also involved, spearheaded by Black British communities, the Sons of Africa, an important Black organisation in Britain, lots of women were also involved in the abolitionist campaign. And when Britain abolished the slave trade, there was still slavery that was occurring within the British Empire. And crucially, you know, Britain's economy was still dependent on the slave trade and on the enslaved in America. I mean, the cotton that was being picked by the enslaved in America, we were still benefiting from. And so Keisha and I really explored this and, asked the question, okay, well, at the beginning of the 19th century, what was the Black British presence? And, you know, towards the end of the 18th century, you know, it's quite hard to get demographic figures, but you had about 10,000 to 20,000 Black people living in Britain. And they were in all different walks of life, predominantly within the working classes, like the majority of the population at that time. And you could experience the Black British community as domestic servants, working as sailors, dock workers, labourers. There was a sort of Black labour aristocracy as well. So you had a range of Black Victorians at the start of this period who were within the working classes, but also within the middle classes and indeed the upper classes as well. So you have a kind of, you can't really homogenize the experience necessarily. They were different individuals in different walks of life.
Let's come back to this idea of social class, because the question is, how visible was the Black community in sources when you're researching your book? And is it dependent on their social class?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, across the piece, really, one of the really challenging things for Keisha and I was to find examples of Black Victorians, across the social spectrum. Now, I think it's really important to state, and we want to be very clear about this, we happily labour in the shadows of many great historians, primarily Black historians before us. So there's a wealth of secondary material on this. And, you know, Black historians have been writing about this since the 19th century. So we're not kind of trailblazers in that sense. So we very much relied on the wealth of secondary material. But we also got very much involved in the archives and different forms of archives. And one of the challenges that you find when you approach the archives is ethnicity wasn't mentioned in the national censuses until 1991. So, you know, when they brought in the national census around 1937, ethnicity wasn't mentioned. So that was one of the areas that made it quite hard to find Black Victorians. You also had, you know, when you go through the censuses, just because someone was born in a particular place, that doesn't necessarily indicate ethnicity. And there were also a range of other sort of genealogical issues that made it challenging. So you had that sort of archival obstruction, if you like. But then there was also whitewashing. There was also general indifference, which meant that a number of key Black Victorians weren't centralized in the history, and you had to really seek to find them. But what we found is whether we were going through different forms of archives, diaries, local collections, books, pamphlets, and of course, secondary material, there were enough resources for us to make the point that Black Victorians weren't just, you know, present in the 19th century, and they were across all social classes, but they were also pivotal and influential in the creation of Great Britain. So in terms of social class, you know, actually it was a general difficulty, but we found numerous examples of Black Victorians in the working, middle and upper classes.
You look at quite a few individuals in the book. This one caught my eye, especially because I live I can see Sheer Nest from here. So William Brown, who was he, and John Finn, and what was their experience of Broadmoor?
Yeah, so in going to all of these different archives, we also went into archives of mental asylums, and that was Bethlehem Royal Hospital and Broadmoor Archives and other private institutions. And the story of William Brown was a really tricky one to tell. And Keisha and I talked a lot about how to effectively tell that story, because it was key for us that we imbued the individuals with agency, used their voice where we could and situated them within broader networks and contexts. You know, we were avoiding this troubling narrative of Black exceptionalism, that there were certain individuals who smashed the glass ceiling and succeeded when others didn't. So we were very kind of careful in our approach to stories. So, but William Brown is a was a case in point where he was born in British Guyana in 1832. He joined the Navy in his mid-20s. And during his career in the Navies, he rose to the rank of petty officer, and he was awarded a medal for good conduct at a time, actually, when Black mariners faced a lot of discrimination. In 1871, he marries and he has two daughters and a son. And he retires from the Navy in 1881 and settles down in Kent. He's got his naval pension and he starts working as a labourer. But unfortunately, as was the case for many sailors, his mental health started to take a turn for the worse. And his story kind of hits the press in 1883 after he had a particular episode which tragically led him to murder his wife and set fire to the house and also attack his stepson who he was living with. So it was a really troubling story, but we pieced together through the archives what happened. We had some help with important archivists in this work, and we followed him to Broadmoor. He was declared criminally insane and sent to Broadmoor, which had been set up in 1863 for the criminally insane. And while at Broadmoor, his mental health, you know, he was crying constantly. He was suicidal. He wasn't eating properly. And he died in Broadmoor shortly afterwards. Now, what was really sort of within this dark story, what was really moving was we found with assistance the letters that one of his daughters wrote to him. She had been taken to a workhouse with her two siblings, and she wrote these really moving letters to her dad, like, "Dear Daddy," informing him of what was happening in the family, and that one of her sisters had gone into domestic service. Her other brother had followed in his footsteps and joined the Navy. And it was really touching to see those letters. So William Brown was one of a number of Black Victorians we found within mental asylums in the 19th century. The other Chris you mentioned, John Flynn, he spent a total of 47 years inside Victorian institutions. He was originally arrested for burglary in 1855. Like William Brown, he had been in the Navy, he'd been a sailor. He was born in the West Indies. Arrested in 1885 for burglary, he's sent to prison, and we went to the Lancashire archives and found some records of his time there. But while in prison, he began manifesting signs of insanity, and he was transferred to Rainhill Asylum, County Asylum, one of three in Lancashire. And while there, and again, we then went to archives to find his case history. And we saw reports of his time there. He was wetting himself frequently. He worked a little. He needed a lot of supervision. There were reports that he started swallowing stones and lead. And I should say, based on the notes that we had, it was saying that he had no education and very little was known about him. Cut a long story short, in 1860, he gets into a fight, he kills another patient, and ultimately ends up in Broadmoor, where he's violent and isolated, and he dies within Broadmoor Mental Asylum, having spent 47 years inside these different institutions. And it was very hard to find much more about John Flynn. But, you know, in our book, we piece together his life from what we can. And one of the empowering things we found in this story was the medical directors who wrote these notes were often very kind of cold and matter of fact in the history notes and in the case file notes. But what came out, and it was just like three words, Bearing in mind that they said he had no education, he didn't know anything about his life. They did report that he said, and I quote, that he was a native of the West Indies. And they got that in the records. And, you know, we talked a lot about that because there was something about that reclamation of identity, that recognition of where he came, despite his inner torment, which was powerful. So, yeah, that's William Brown and John Flynn.
I think we should continue this thing about people individually because it's really interesting. I'm really fascinated. I'm sitting at the edge of my seat right now and I need to know more about the people that you've written about. So tell us, who was Edward Albert? Because he was quite an interesting person, wasn't he?
Edward Albert, yeah, another fascinating character who, you know, in our book, we look at kind of different areas of the social spectrum. And Edward Albert was one within in the working classes. And again, like William Brown and John Flynn, he had worked in the Navy. He joined the Royal Navy when he was about 9 years old. He was born in Jamaica. And he worked his way up he started as a cabin boy before he became cook and eventually head cook. And in 1851, he goes on a journey from Glasgow to China on one of the ships that he's working off. And it's when he's off the coast of Cape Horn, the temperatures plummet and he suffers frostbite to his legs. And the crew on the ship decide to put his legs in an oven to try and cure the frostbite. And, you know, there's some very, very harrowing descriptions from Edward Albert himself. And again, you know, Keisha and I talked a lot about how do you give these individuals a voice, and where we could, we went to the sources to get their voice. And I might say a bit more about Edward Albert's voice. But they put his legs in an oven and they burst, and he essentially loses both his legs and is dumped by his shipmates in Latin America and has to make his way home. And so he meets Henry Mayhew, shortly after this. Now, Henry Mayhew is a social investigator who was going out and writing about the London poor at the time. And Mayhew speaks to Edward Albert, who tells him his story. Now, what's really interesting about Edward Albert is he's determined, he says this to Mayhew, he's determined to get his rights. He wants to get the money that he's owed from that ship. A huge injustice has been done to him, and he's determined to get what's rightly his wages from that ship. So when he meets Henry Mayhew, he's living this sort of transitory life between Glasgow and London. And now he finds some temporary success in Glasgow, and he opens a coffee house and sells homemade pastries until that business collapses and he moves down to London, where he's living amongst the working classes and he's sweeping the streets. He's a crossing sweeper. Now, Mayhew, in his book, London Labour and the London Poor, introduces Edward Albert as a crossing sweeper who has lost both his legs. And he sort of classifies him within the sort of working class wanderers, you know, those who live a transitory life at the time and are living on the breadline. Yeah, when you dig into Edward Albert's story, you start seeing that actually that's a really unfair, massively unfair characterization. Someone who worked in the Navy, he had a family as well, someone who started his own business, and crucially, wrote his own memoir, which he sold on the streets. And so that memoir had been found by another literary scholar. We got that memoir and we used that as a basis to, you know, construct his life and give Edward Albert a voice. So again, there was this very sad and traumatic and troubling story that Keisha and I explored. And yet, even within that, there's this real sense of agency and a fight. Edward Albert determined to get his rights and wasn't just a crossing sweeper who'd lost both his legs, but was a man who had a, you know, fascinating and varied career in history.
And another individual that comes up was William Cuffey, if I've got the pronunciation right. I mean, I did the Chartists at school, God, a long time ago, and it wasn't a name I recognised, but he was actually a Chartist campaigner who campaigned for male suffrage and a fair electoral system. But how, as a man of colour, how was he viewed by his contemporaries and even by the people he was trying to get voting rights for?
Mm. So, yeah, William Cuffey, born in Kent, very much within the press, described as a sort of militant black Chartist leader who was ultimately charged with trying to levy war against the Queen. Now, that, you know, pan out, and you know, there's a number of black Victorians who were involved in politics and the fight for working class rights, and William Cuffey was one of those. And, you know, he wasn't just a sort of side piece in the Chartist movement. He was absolutely essential to it. And we explore that within our book. At the time, the press very much demonized him. I mean, Punch, the satirical newspaper, you know, mocked him, mocked his skin color, really demonized him. The Times, on the other hand, sort of presented him as this kind of destabilizing alien import, if you like, who was causing trouble amongst the working classes and was causing trouble for the establishment. And even within the sort of the working class press, it was really interesting how he was presented, because some of the presentations of William Cuffey, it, you know, focused on the colour of his skin and presented him almost as if he was grateful that Britain had abolished slavery, and therefore he was sort of continuing the fight for liberty by working and leading the working classes to emancipation. So, you know, the colour of his skin was a really important piece in how he was perceived, and on the whole it led to general denigration. And he was found guilty in 1848 at the Old Bailey and transported for life to Australia. And he settled in Tasmania, where he died. Unfortunately, racism was rife, and William Cuffey was not just fighting against an oppressive state and an oppressive system, but also, you know, connected to that racism.
Sorry, I got so involved in listening to you speak. I was like, wait, hold on a minute. I've got to ask the next question. You have drawn me into this so much that I think we could sit here and listen for ages. But Sarah Forbes Bonetta, if I've pronounced that correctly.
Yeah.
She was a social experiment by the noble classes to prove that no matter your race, you could be improved, with quotation marks, as they saw it. How true is this?
I think that's a really fair assessment of Sarah Forbes Bonetta, and historian Caroline Bressy has done a lot of work on her story, as has others. And she, Sarah Forbes Bonetta, she comes to Britain in 1850, having essentially been given to a British naval captain as a gift to Queen Victoria. She was from present-day Benin, at the time known as Dahomey, and it's not really clear what happened in the early phase of her life, but she was captured by the King of Dahomey, kept at his palace and given over as a gift, in quotation marks, to this British naval captain, who brings her over to Britain. So she meets Queen Victoria in 1850, and, cut a long story short, it's decided that she should go into missionary circles, that she should be educated, and she's taken to Sierra Leone, to West Africa, where she's trained up in missionary work. She then comes back to Britain in 1855 and is raised with missionaries. Now, the idea, I think, for this was that she would be seen as someone who could prove that with British civilization, Christianity, all, you know, quotation marks, that if she could be improved, that so could the rest of the African people. And, you know, the other kind of side to that was she was also expected to conform to the Victorian ideals of womanhood. So in 1862, she marries a Yorubian polymath from Sierra Leone in a ceremony in Brighton. And so, you know, again, we explore her full life within the book, but I think it's very much fair to say that she's seen as this kind of opportunity to improve African people and prove that the missionary endeavor, which was so important for many in the 19th century, had legs, if you like, that, you know, Britain could go out and save souls spread Christianity. So she fits into a kind of broader practice of missionary work at the time.
Another way for communities to become more visible is through art and culture. What was the Black community's impact on British culture, like art and theatre?
It was massive. I mean, it's so hard to answer that question because it depends, you know, in what area of culture you look at. So, I mean, whether it's in music, whether it's in theatre, whether it's in the circus, whether it's you name it, there's an important contribution. There's a few individuals that we explore in the book who kind of exemplify that contribution. One being Ira Aldridge, who had a career spanning like 40 years. He performed across Europe, Russia, Austro-Hungary Empire, and he performed in Shakespearean plays, abolitionist melodramas, comedy, and although he faced a lot of racism, particularly in London, he performed in like Othello, Richard III, Hamlet. He adapted his own plays, so he brought an adaptation of The Black Doctor to the stages of Britain in 1847. He adapted Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, which hadn't been seen for like over 100 years, in 1850, and you know, although he faced racism, he was also praised in the press, in some quarters of the press, for his acting abilities. So in the realm of theatre, you have a litany of Black Victorians who contributed to the development of theatre at the time. In the realm of other forms of kind of more popular entertainment, someone like Pablo Fanque, William Darby, who was born in a workhouse in 1810 in Norwich. He's apprenticed to the circus from a young age. In 1841, he starts his own circus. And by the mid-19th century, he's filling amphitheatres of 3,000 people or more. And he really did a lot to bring respectability to the circus, which in the early 19th century was seen as a sort of kind of stigmatized, lowly form of entertainment. And by the end of the 19th century, it was a very commercial, respectable form of entertainment. So someone like Pablo Fanque had a really important role in the development of culture in that sense. Then within the realms of, I mean, I could go on, and literature and art as well. Someone like Fanny Eaton, who was born in Jamaica, and met Simeon Solomon, a kind of upcoming painter within pre-Raphaelite circles. Fanny Eaton became, as some historians have described it, a kind of pre-Raphaelite muse. She was painted by numerous different pre-Raphaelite painters, and, you know, entered and informed that visual landscape alongside many others as well. And again, let me just stress, when I highlight these individuals, these are not isolated cases, but form part of a broader network. So across culture, you have an important Black presence. Music is a whole other stream. And in our book, we talk about Samuel Coleridge Taylor, who was born in Britain and brought the sounds of the African diaspora to life. And, you know, his Hiawatha Wedding Feast, which premiered in 1898, was played across the world. So all different forms is a long, convoluted way of saying, like, in all different forms of culture, there was a really important Black contribution to different spheres within the realm of culture.
You bring so many individual stories to light, and I love this. I am enjoying myself beyond anything listening to all these individual stories. But you must have one which was the most moving for you, or one that was the most interesting for you.
Oh yeah, so Keisha would give a different answer. I think Keisha, you know, she's a scholar of the African diaspora and post-colonial literature, and a very proud Black feminist who's done a lot of work within this space. And she was very much drawn to the sort of Black abolitionists who came over to Britain in the 19th century, people like Sarah Parker Raymond, who really called Britain out for, you know, their previous involvement in slavery, but also to highlight the ills of slavery in America at the time. So I'm sure unfortunately she's not here, but Keisha would give an answer that would focus on African Americans and their contribution and important work in forwarding the abolitionist course in Great Britain. From my perspective, you know, it's so hard to highlight a single individual. I mean, Samuel Crowther, I was really drawn to his story. Black bishop who was ordained into the Church of England in the 1840s, and at Canterbury Cathedral in 1864, was given the bishopric of Niger in West Africa. So this was a Black bishop who was moving in the, you know, the corridors of Lambeth Palace, met Queen Victoria, and you know, in a way kind of goes back to Sarah Forbes Bonetta as well. He was part of a kind of drive to spread Christianity, an example of a Black Victorian that, you know, unlike Edward Albert or William Brown or John Flynn, wasn't on the social margins, but was really kind of within the upper echelons of society. And yeah, I found his story fascinating. So that's a really bad answer. Like there's so many to choose from.
That makes it all the more interesting that instead of, yeah, there's just one person in the entire period. It's like, there's so many, it makes it much more engaging story. But the Victorian period is quite long, and the nature of the country and society changes between her coronation and her death in 1901. So we have a new century, a whole different outlook for most of the world, but had anything changed for the Black community? And if so, was it for the better?
Mm. I mean, so, you know, again, going back to that point of, you know, Black history and British history being intimately intertwined, you know, general improvements in sanitation and health and transportation links and all of that, which that benefited everyone. So that included Black Victorians within that. And there remained massive social ills that affected everyone. Within the realm of, you know, racism across the 19th century, you see a hardening of racial attitudes, particularly with, you know, different discourses in the realm of science. The spread of blackface minstrelsy really started to kind of import ideas of Black inferiority. Not import, that's the wrong way of phrasing it. Really started to proliferate within a popular realm the idea of Black inferiority, which was already being sort of bolstered in scientific circles. Various events abroad also led to a hardening of racial attitudes in Britain. So, you know, attitudes became even more intense. By, you know, 1919, you have a series of race riots, you know, explodes in a series of race riots from South Shield, Salford, Hull, London, Liverpool, Cardiff, with white people attacking Black and Asian seamen. So you see this sort of rise in racism, And then you've also got kind of important countervailing forces at the same time. Pan-Africanism, for example, by the end of the 19th century, in 1900, you have the first Pan-African conference in London, in Westminster, which was, you know, designed to assert the social, political and legal rights of Black people across the globe. You had the rise of a Black British press. You had, you know, not even the rise, maybe not even the right word. You had greater or renewed networks and contacts between Black Victorians across the globe. So there were kind of countervailing forces as well. But, you know, life for many people remained very difficult. And yeah, the 20th century becomes a whole different other story.
Yeah, John, this has been absolutely fantastic. We could probably sit here talking about this for the rest of the day. I know Alina's really enjoying it as well. Could you just remind everyone what the book's title is, where they can get it, and when it's available? I believe it's out now, isn't it?
Yes, it's out now. So it's by myself and Dr. Keisha Abraham. It's called Black Victorians Hidden in History. And yeah, hopefully available at all good bookstores, and is a small contribution to a much broader historiography on this. We're always keen to stress that we, as I said, happily labour in the shadows of many, but hopefully, you know, it provides a good introduction to this you know, fascinating topic, and yeah, I hope people enjoy the book and get something from it.
Hopefully Keisha can join us next time, because I think that would be make a really interesting conversation.
Absolutely.
John, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.